Hello and welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin. I'm a senior editor at the Mises Institute. And with me again is Tho Bishop, my associate editor. And we're back again to talk about democracy like last time. This time we're going to cover a little bit different area. We're going to talk about Hoppe and Rothbard and Hayek and some of their ideas about democracy and how it can be used or made to work a little bit better. And we'll just be a little bit more on the theoretical level this time than last time. So, Tho, how you doing?
Doing well. It's going to be a fun conversation.
Well, I hope so. When we looked at the comments from our last video, there seemed to be a lot of responses that took a more simple view than what we were saying. Basically, well, democracy is the worst thing ever. The only way you can improve is get rid of it entirely. And with no helpful explanation of how that might be done. So, although that's often the case. Often when we talk about democracy, we seem to get two responses from our core readers. We get one from the more conservative side of people, and that's the whole "we're a republic, not a democracy" argument. Now, I've written a whole column about that, on how that's basically a unhelpful and useless slogan that communicates almost no information. I guess all it does is signal, I don't like majoritarian politics. Okay, that's fine, but almost no content is ever accompanying that slogan. But that's not what we were encountering this time, mostly. It was the other side of things, which is the more diehard libertarian Hoppean side of things, which is democracy, that is, voting of any kind, is terrible, and we need some sort of authoritarian system where nobody's allowed to vote. Obviously, not exactly the imagined system from 18th century America. So, what? So is that good? Should we be doing that, though?
As members of the Mises Institute, you know, we encounter a lot of diversity, I think, actually, in terms of, you know, political theories, in terms of, and a lot of this is shaped by different countries, different histories and all this sort of stuff, and it's very interesting. One of the questions that I think comes across when you have people that understand the value of the marketplace and they understand the importance of voluntary political arrangements and this sort of stuff is kind of the question is, okay, well, why should we care about politics at all? You know, what is the value of kind of looking at the nuance when we know that, you know, the state is a group of thieves writ large and all that sort of stuff? And it's a very fair question. And I think that there's a lot of, there's a fine argument to be made that ignoring politics entirely might be very good for your psychological well-being. And I certainly do not fault anybody that kind of has that retreatist mindset of, okay, I'm just going to have a family and a farm and not care about the outside world. And yeah, this is my little slice of liberty. And that, I think that's great. But I do think that there is value for, understanding the mechanisms that govern the world as it exists right now. You know, how do we make political orders better rather than the ideal and one big step? And obviously, you know, Rothbard himself, you know, did a lot of work in trying to understand how, you know, this idea of strategies for liberty. How do you take these ideas and put them in the real world? Dr. Hoppe, he's given a number of talks over the years of kind of, you know, how do we make this a practical approach to the you know, world of private governance that I think most of kind of people in our orbit desire. Because again, just ignoring these questions don't make them go away. Politics itself is kind of fundamentally about persuasion. And so, you know, understanding and looking at, you know, some of the real trade-offs that you get, you know, that's what economics is all about, right? Understanding trade-offs. So that, you know, if, you know, what does it look like to, you know, to make a democratic society, you know, more free? What does it look like? You know, what are the advantages that you have there relative to other systems like monarchies and everything else? What are the disadvantages? Groups of people always follow the same incentive structures? I mean, I think even that there's a lot of differences throughout history, and there's a lot of differences and outcomes there that are worth kind of diving into if you are interested in, you know, kind of political science at all as a subject. So hopefully with sort of these conversations, which is a kind of, I think, a little bit different content, a different type of content than a lot of the stuff that we provide, We're kind of digging into some issues that I think are important, but may not be for everyone, and that's okay too.
Well, for starters, you should probably summarize for us, though, just the real quick, the basics of Hoppe's critique. My impression is that when people act like they're big Hoppians and they hate democracy for that reason, when I read deeper, it usually seems that the person who made the comment hasn't actually read the book, Democracy, the God That Failed, although I'm sure sometimes they have. But there seems to usually just be a very vulgar, simplistic idea behind what he's saying there. And maybe you can give us just a little bit better idea of what the nuance is there.
There's this kind of edgelord factor to Hoppe, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, within the internet culture, right, the way that ideas translate, I think the history of memes and its influence on global politics is actually a really, really fascinating subject. Particularly, when we understand the way that ideas shape society, I have an article on this. The fact that some people see very superficial details of what Hoppe has written about. Obviously, the best example, obviously, is Triple H Physical Removal Service, where you have all these memes about Hoppe throwing communists out of helicopters in this Pinochet sort of fashion, which I always thought was kind of ironic because, like, Hayek, who a lot of online Hoppians kind of make fun of, Hayek had some nicer things to say about Pinochet than Hoppe has. These aren't kind of great, in-depth analysis of Hoppe's work. They're just kind of little caricatures that translate, make for good online humor. Anything that drives people to look at the underlying ideas is a good thing. Hoppe's critique on democracy has a lot to do with the incentive structures in place. If you're dealing with a monarch that has a longer time preference that has to, is not concerned about winning his election every 4 years, they have a structure there that incentivizes thinking, in the long term. What is the best for preserving a longer society, whereas kind of democracy kind of creates this race to the bottom of you're trying to bribe voters in election processes, you're trying to get as many people into your camp as possible, that the dynamic there incentivizes bad policy, whereas more permanent political structures promote being good stewards of political arrangements. And the role of time preference is obviously, I think, a very important role in economic calculations, I think a lot of it does. Heightening our time preference, I think, is definitely create all sorts of problems with society as it exists today. But I don't think it's necessarily true that in all democratic systems, you have this race of who's going to bribe the most voters in a very narrow sense of self-interest. And in fact, within kind of American political science literature, you've seen all this, you've seen a lot of people kind of confused on why is it that people in Kansas vote for a Republican Party that, was characterized as being the party of the Chamber of Commerce and the yacht clubs rather than blue collar union hall workers. And it's because there's more there that goes in the democratic process and individual decision making than who's going to give me the biggest check. And so I think that when we look at how you navigate dealing with these sort of societies, you're trying to better understand that and trying to figure out the mechanisms that can perhaps lead to better outcomes is something that has some value.
So if we had to reduce Hoppe to one sentence, we might say, all else being equal, once the voters figure out that they can just vote themselves free money, then they'll do so. The question is all else equal? And clearly, Mises, Ludwig von Mises, considered this issue, as we discussed last time in Bureaucracy and in other works. He's talked about the issue of once you have a mass of the voters, a majority who concludes it's easier to just vote themselves free pensions and so on, then you have a serious problem as a democratic state of some kind. The question is, When does that occur? Does it always occur? How fast does it occur? Is there any way to prevent that? Mises's view was that if people subscribe to a liberal ideology, that is classical liberal, then it won't happen immediately and may actually give you a very well-functioning state for quite a long time, provided that people have the proper view of the functions of the state. So are things always equal? It appears not. Just as you said, there are other factors, there are other issues that go into how people vote other than, can I just vote myself a free check? Now, certainly some people do that. So we have to look then at the actual historical context then, I think. And it's always real important to say what we mean by democracy, because obviously democracy in some multi-ethnic African state where they just have some big mass election and there's no federalism, that's one thing. In Switzerland, it's something else entirely. And so if we just blithely refer to all those things as democracy, it doesn't really tell us very much at all about what sort of regime we're talking about. So in the American context, then, we've got two periods, I think, that we would describe as the most democratic periods in terms of expanding the vote, in terms of relying on a voting mass to deliver what it is the ascendant political group wants, or at least one of the major groups want. And the first of those is Jacksonian, the Jacksonian period. And the second one is the old so-called Bourbon Democrats, or just really the Democrats. The Bourbons was actually a slur created by their enemies. And so we've got two periods of that where there was a concerted effort to expand the vote. And this was believed to actually expand liberty and to cut off the power of minority groups, rich people, powerful people who controlled, say, the central bank and other institutions. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about the first of those periods, the Jacksonians.
It's interesting because the Jacksonian era is often kind of sold as kind of a continuation of some of like this, the Jeffersonian idealism, when in reality, kind of the Virginian decision makers that had controlled politics in America, you know, since Jefferson's election, looked very down upon Jackson. You know, their candidate at that time was guy named William Crawford, who ended up having a debilitating stroke. He still beat Henry Clay in an election that year, but Martin Van Buren actually was initially an ally of Crawford, and so they were trying to kind of prop him up without letting people know of how bad his health was after that stroke. Jackson was seen as kind of a weapon against the elite by a group of voters that now had political power they did not have before, the expansion of the franchise. That was an original sort of American populist movement against what had been a pre-existing political dynasty there with the Virginian control of things. And he represented, a Western territory that was, you did not have the longest last, you know, the same sort of longevity of within the American Union of kind of some of these great political families of New England and other elsewhere. And so again, that was a very democratic skepticism of established power, as you know, Rothbard wrote about in this a topic that Patrick Newman covered during the Supporters Summit this year in Jekyll Island. Jackson's war against the bank and financial interest was a major defining point of his presidency, a lot of that goes to a democratic check against perceived privilege of, when you have a small elite benefiting at the expense of the rest. Here is a way where that liberty versus power dynamic that, Rothbard kind of looked the lens of history at, actually a democratic system was used as a check against a minority of powerful people. We don't want to go overboard in praising Jackson's presidency. Obviously, there's a lot of aspects there that, he wasn't exactly the great states' white rights champion that he is sometimes described as. There's all sorts of interesting things and nuances there typically is in history. Here's an example of democracy being used as a check against the powers of the elite. It's a very interesting episode in early American history.
And of course, universal manhood suffrage, at least for white people, comes in that period. And it was very expansive. Like, they weren't kidding. So this was a departure from earlier notions where you had to be property owning and you had to be well established within your community. And there were many more limitations prior to this. You might even maybe in much earlier times had to have been members of an established church and things like that. And those ideas go back to 17th century England. But they moved away from that in the 19th century. So now basically any man who wasn't black, for the most part, because this would include even out in Western territories by mid-century, would include many people who were of Mexican descent. In some places, it would include Asians, even some Indians who were no longer affiliated with a tribe and so on. And so it was, in the big scheme of things, historically, extremely democratic, more democratic than England, which was the most democratic country in Europe at the time, because at the time in the 1830s and then again in the 1860s, the British were expanding their franchise to the middle classes and then even down into the working classes. And this was seen as a very democratic move, much more so than was going on certainly in Central Europe, and certainly more so than in Spain and other countries. But that was nothing compared to what was going on in the United States in terms of expanding the vote. So that was a big component of what the Jacksonians were trying to do. And then that continued after the Civil War again with the Democrats of that period. And the Democrats, I should be clear, were the good party in the late 19th century. This was the party that was in favor of local control. They tended to be against tariffs. The Republicans were for big punitive tariffs and so on. They were for, at least in the case of the Cleveland Democrats, in favor of hard money. And it was only later that she had William Jennings Bryan with this whole cross of gold speech and all of that, ruined all of that. But for a period there, the Democrats were far and away the best party. But they were also very much in favor of expanding the franchise to many immigrants. It was Cleveland who vetoed a bill to require for immigrants literacy tests before they could vote. And on the same issue, they were allowing states to unilaterally expand who could vote on their own. And I cover this in an article on how immigrants were allowed to vote in these territories in the West. And this wasn't just west of the Mississippi. This included some new territories like even in the Midwest, say Wisconsin and Iowa, which I suppose is west of the Mississippi. But not that far west. And you had that, and certainly in Colorado, cases where immigrants, all they had to do was announce an intent to become a citizen, and then they could vote. And effectively, since the state let them vote, they could vote in federal elections as well. And this was all based on the idea, which was very popular at the time, that your ability to vote didn't depend on your background. It just depended on where you were living at that time, because you were affected by the laws in that place. So those people should be able to vote, even if they were very, very new to the location. And that was the view of a great many Democrats at the time. And so they weren't joking about this sort of thing. And in Colorado, of course, and in New Mexico and any of those other places, this include also a lot of Hispanics. And you see that in some commentary at the time where Susan B. Anthony, for example, was complaining about how she had to go and try and convince quote-unquote Mexican greasers to vote for women's suffrage in southern Colorado. And she found that to be a big hassle. And so this vote was not just simply reserved to influential white people. It was quite expansive. The Democrats wanted these new immigrants to be able to vote. But they didn't imagine that this would all necessarily mean that we're all going to become communists now because more people are voting. And so when we look at the historical context, it's clear that in many cases, it was the anti-government power party that wanted to expand the vote, both the Jacksonians in many ways, not in every way, and then later with the Cleveland Democrats, I guess we'll just call them. And so were they just wrong? Or was there something to their idea that we need these votes then to counter this centralized power that's in Washington?
Throughout American history, you have this interesting, and you're kind of seeing it with parallels in kind of this Trump environment. You saw it within parallels of the Pat Buchanan environment, the 90s, which obviously so fascinated Rothbard. is that, you know, when you have a situation where you have an understanding that there's some people benefiting at the expense of the rest, you know, the ability for, a political equivalent of mobs with pitchforks and torches, you know, democracy can be a very interesting check against, centralized control. And you know, there's a lot of if you look throughout American history, I mean, Rothbard I think highlighted this in some of the during the Progressive Era and some of the lead up to some of the really expansive control of government is that often it is a there's a very elitist group of people that are the ones most desiring of a centralized government that has all these powers. To remake society, right? It's not necessarily the stupidity of the masses that build up these cathedrals of state power. It is a very specialized group of elite that lack the hubris and had to have all these very grandiose visions of what they could do if only they were able to have the power, and that they are often the ones that check away some of the restrictions that have been put in place. Because, I mean, obviously, if you look at it, going back to like the idea of, you know, what is American democracy different, you know, makes it different in some of these other areas is that, you know, there are some institutional checks and balances to what the majority can decide. Right. And it's interesting because you do have this battle within a democratic system that, you know, this came up with Jackson, right? When Jackson was elected, like he wanted to abolish the Electoral College. He thought that because he was the representative of the masses, that therefore he should be the most powerful agent within the federal government, that you know, his whims should oversee any interpretation by the courts or by the legislature, that he alone speaks for the people. So there is this interesting dynamic there where, you know, if you do have that political support of the masses, does that mean that you should have the ability to override these very explicit design checks on that control, those checks and political norms have kind of eroded over time, particularly in the 20th century, it's not necessarily a rush to bribe people or the masses not understanding the consequences of their actions that end up leading to a very powerful state. It is often a very small minority that have these very grand visions that can give these things. There's a lot more here that needs to be reckoned with.
Well, I'd like to mention just a couple of books that I think are relevant to this issue, provide some historical context. One is a book called The Virgin Vote by a person named John Grinspan. And I've mentioned this in a couple of articles I've written. And this talks about really the youth vote in mid-19th century America. But it provides a nice, useful picture of how party politics worked at the time. And it should be noted that partisan politics in mid-19th century was not a genteel and polite affair. It was, in many ways, like now, people brought up politics at very inopportune times. They hadn't all agreed to never talk about politics like they did in mid-century America. And people very much took the position that if I'm a Democrat and you're a Republican, we have nothing to talk about and we probably shouldn't hang out with each other. And this was fairly easy to pull off because a lot of these people were divided geographically in many cases, but there was a lot of hostility between the two groups. Now, given what we know now in terms of the actual power exercised by the federal government, it seems a little bit over the top because in terms of your daily life, it probably really didn't matter that Millard Fillmore was elected president, even if you were on the other side, because what was he going to do and what sort of powers could he actually exercise that might ruin your life, at least from the federal level. It was really the locus of political power was much more at the state and local level. Nevertheless, people got really worked up about that sort of thing, and it's fun to read. So that's one book, The Virgin Vote. And another book is called The Transatlantic Persuasion, and this book's out of print. It's from 1967, I believe, by a man named Robert Kelly. And this talks about the Cleveland Democrats, also talks about the Democratic movements under Gladstone, and also how it worked in Canada during this period and looks at the general views behind all of these groups. This is a general liberal program, classical liberal program of expanding the vote for the purpose of limiting government power. And interestingly, in another book that recently came out called American Secession by F.H. Buckley, he talks about that too, how secession can actually be a tool then to increase the power of local majorities who could fight back then against centralized power. And so it wasn't always the case, as a lot of people, especially that whole we're a republic, not a democracy crowd, try and make it look like, oh, it's always been the voting majority that's the real threat to liberty. But a great many Americans throughout history, especially the Jacksonians, Cleveland himself, Jefferson, all those Democrats and Democratic Republicans from the earlier period viewed these small elites as the real problem. And going then into sort of the application, so we need to ask ourselves, what are good and bad strategies for liberty? I know from experience that I've been, that has made me question the idea that handing over everything to the control of some wealthy elites would be a great idea. I was involved in state politics for a long time in Colorado, and Colorado has a thing where you can't get a tax increase unless the voters approve it at the state level. Now, you can get a local tax increase if the people in that jurisdiction approve it. And the voters here have a long history of turning down those attempted tax increases. But if you get yourself alone in a room with a bunch of captains of industry and the elites of the state, they complain constantly about how these dumb voters won't approve tax increases. And boy, if we could only get rid of that constitutional amendment, which gives the public a vote on tax increases, we could finally fund all the important things we need to fund in this state, more higher ed, more highways, convention centers, all of that stuff. And the dumb voters keep ruining everything. And boy, we would spend so much more government money if we could just wrench the vote from the hands of these voters again. So witnessing that more than a few times, I think, thank goodness the voters still have some say in this, because you hand it over to the Chamber of Commerce and so on, they're going to immediately start advocating for tax increases. So at least at the state level, my basic experience has not necessarily led me to believe that, boy, the wealthy and the intelligent automatically have this long-term view and they want the private sector to take over.
Yeah, that's been my experience as well. A couple of years ago, I was talking with a member of that Chamber of Commerce crowd here locally, and they were talking about what Pensacola was able to do and we are not able to do, and just bemoaning the fact that, oh, well, they have a public library tax of a certain amount percent. And just imagine what we could do if we had a public library tax. And I was just cringing in my chair at the very idea of that. It's often the fact that and you see that play out all the time in local government and all sorts of things, that, you know, like a lot of these same people that, you know, they may wear the red hat, you know, during most political conversations, because that is this sort of demographic that they're trying to play to. And they can afford to do that on kind of disconnected local or national politics. But at local decision making, they're absolutely convinced that, you know, you just give them more money, then they're going to make the right decisions, because it's, you know, they're the ones actually making the decisions. And things are going to be better off. And it's often not that case at all. There is a humility that can kind of be that democracy can bring over what a small group thinks that they can do, there's a check there. It's something that can be definitely abused, but it's not quite as simplistic as a lot of people would like to believe.
Well, going back to the are all things equal question, is, okay, so we have a tax increase that's up for vote at the statewide level. A lot of people clearly believe when they vote against these taxes, which they voted down 4 tax increases in the last major election here, which I guess was 2016? No, 2018 was the last gubernatorial election here. So at the same time the voters approved Jared Polis, a Democrat, they voted down 4 tax increases. So sort of suggesting that just because we vote for a Democrat doesn't mean we want tax increases. And so the question is, okay, well, why didn't a majority of those people just vote themselves free money? Well, clearly, a significant portion of those people, rightly or wrongly, viewed themselves as the people who pay the taxes, not the people who receive them. And so things aren't all equal. You might have a place where, yep, we can just vote ourselves away to just fleece the rest of the population. But apparently a lot of people seem to think they're the rest of the population, the ones who are getting fleeced if there's a tax increase. Now, if you run the numbers, that may not be true. There might have been a lot of people who voted against the tax increase who might have benefited from it directly in terms of free money. And that's actually the argument the left makes a lot of times. Why don't you just vote yourself free money? And a lot of people don't anyway, because they maybe see the implications of that and the problem of that. They also maybe think in terms of their descendants and so on. Maybe I don't want to saddle my children with a huge tax bill because it's not like that's some distant future. If you have a 10-year-old now, in 10 years, he's going to be paying those taxes as an adult.
And that's why like a Mises Institute audience should understand as well as anyone that, you know, value is subjective, right? It's not simply about the dollar amount that a politician's promising you. I mean, there's a lot of people, if you look at this past Democratic primary, for example, you know, the candidate that was offering the most free goods was Bernie Sanders. But there's the majority of the Democrats at the end of the day, I think we're voting for a nostalgic idea of a return to the Obama days. And so they voted for Joe Biden of all people, you know, not the most energetic candidate, you know, not the most, charismatic candidate, not the one that's offering the most robust a bill of goods. He's just a return to normality, right? And that's what a lot of the anti-Trump buildup right now is a return to that normality. Meanwhile, on the Trump side, I give a lot of people that, you know, they might not, you know, a lot of them probably are happy with a tax cut, but have big concerns about spending. But at the end of the day, you know, the value of voting for Trump is the amount of pain that it will inflict upon a group of people that, you know, that have, you know, are very, very obnoxious about their political views. And that's that alone justifies a vote. You know, people make their decision making. It's not simply about, you know, how do you get the biggest bang for the buck for your vote? There's a number of factors there because we all have our, you know, different values that you know, and, you know, rightly or wrongly, it's, you know, there's plenty of, you know, research out there. Oh, your one vote doesn't matter. But there's a lot of people that just get value on casting that one ballot for whatever reason they have. Yeah, that gives them some satisfaction, and that works.
Well, this brings us then to the issue of what are some of these factors then that prevent people from just voting themselves free money? And the whole Hayekian intellectual trickle-down effect. Right. Now, I know a lot of people scoff at this, right? This, oh, people don't care about ideas or ideology. And I believe it was Hayek who said something to the effect of people who think that ideology doesn't affect people's views are usually in the thrall of the ideology of some dead economist. I'm paraphrasing, but I think it was Hayek who said that. And right, if someone thinks that ideology doesn't matter, it just means they're completely unaware of what ideologies have affected them. But nobody's unaffected by ideology. People believe some sort of worldview. They believe some sort of narrative. And the fact is, when people vote against tax increases, they're believing some sort of narrative which says tax increases hurt your economy in the long run, or it's going to come back and cost you big time. Where did they get those ideas? Who can say specifically? But chances are good they got it from somebody who was repeating old liberal talking points from the 19th century, back when people used to actually argue that tax increases were bad. Maybe someone in the Democratic Party in the United States back in the 1880s. So that's an important issue. And Hayek was right. Those ideas trickle down. Ideology matters. And that can keep voters from simply just deciding that the democracy is a chance for me to screw over everybody else. Mises seemed to believe the same thing, was if you have a society that's based on liberal ideas, then people aren't going to just immediately pursue a policy of just using the power of the state to destroy everybody else. And those factors matter. They exist. If they didn't exist, then yeah, we would have descended in just a total democratic free-for-all a long time ago.
One of the things that I think that I've noticed when talking with a lot of libertarians, things like this, and this kind of goes to, I think, some of the criticisms that Jeff Dice has had about political universalism, right? The idea that, oh, there's a single libertarian political structure that's just right for everyone. It's the idea that there's a specific strategy for liberty that is equally applicable everywhere. And I think there's a lot of differences based on the institutions within a society, or are the masses more open to skepticism of big government programs, or are they more open to that? I think there's a lot of factors that shape how that those views are, because there's no shortcut. If the ideas that dominate the intellectual zeitgeist, if those are bad, then all the structures in place that you build up, those can all kind of be eroded if the public has kind of this has a suicidal ideology motivating it. I mean, there's not a lot of ways of stopping it. And that's where Mises talks a lot about the way that ideas shape society. And so sometimes that can come down from this Hayekian idea of trickle down the second handlers of ideas. If you have a good intellectual elite promoting the right ideas downwards, then the population itself can come to these proper classical liberal ideas. Rothbard, when he in the 90s was writing about what's the best strategy for liberty in America as it existed, he had a much more cynical view of the way that these institutions were actually operating in the U.S. He's like, obviously the people that are benefiting the most from the state that has been constructed are not going to be giving the most honest analysis of the state as it exists, and therefore you have an incentive structure for beltway think tanks and colleges relying upon public grant money and the media that kind of enjoys being in the halls of power. Their incentive is not to inform the public on what the best policy is. Their incentive is to maintain the sweet gig that they have for themselves. And therefore, the best way of effecting a change in a more libertarian anti-state direction is to take kind of that more Jacksonian model of calling out the elites as being the problem and getting the public to rise up. And again, there's a lot of... Meanwhile, if you talk to a lot of libertarians in South America, they're very skeptical of the value of populism because they've seen that same model go in a very negative direction and lead to Chavez in Venezuela and other communist strongmen like that. So again, where things are, it's there's not a simple answer to how do we reduce the state. There's a lot that is unique to the people and the population and the institutions within a society that can shape how these mechanisms go.
Yeah, institutions matter. It should be noted that most Latin American countries have a much more unitary political system for their regimes, a lot less decentralization, much more majoritarian in nature, and... this is partly due to the fact that their political institutions come down from Spain rather than Britain. And there's just less of a devotion to really hammering into place the idea that geographically based minority groups should be able to defend themselves from the larger majority. Now, certainly on paper, there is decentralization in Latin America. It's Mexico's official name is the United States of Mexico, and Brazil has states and that sort of thing. But even a lot of those countries like Peru and Chile and so on, Bolivia, have really almost no decentralization at all in terms of formal lawmaking and how their legislatures are comprised. And that's certainly a factor because it's difficult for a minority group that might exist in one part of the country to really cancel out the will of the majority or at least provide roadblocks in its way. And there is, of course, the ideological factor as well in many ways. And almost nowhere did liberalism implant itself as thoroughly as it did in the United States and to a lesser extent in Canada and the United Kingdom. But really, the United States is the only truly liberal country left on Earth, I think. And even here, it's getting fairly weak right now. But in most of the world, it's much, much weaker, including in other Anglo-Saxon countries. And boy, you could see that right now in Australia with their lockdowns and all of that. And So what does that mean? What are the strategies? Well, clearly ideology is an issue, as Hayek and Mises would both say. But decentralization is an important factor as well, as we discussed last time. But let's finish up by talking about Hoppe a little bit then. Because Hoppe, in his essay, What Must Be Done, he talks about strategies for really diminishing the power of the state. And he doesn't say, well, you know, this essay is one page long, get rid of democracy, and everything will be fine. Obviously, he doesn't say that. In fact, he just assumes democracy is a well-embedded institution within the political systems he's talking about. And he's mostly talking about the American context. But what he really says is that America should start breaking itself up into small pieces. I recognize that there are some parts in America where the voters, the majority of the voters, are actually very much pro-liberty. And those places are going to be well-run. They're going to be act as local bastions of really returning the United States, or in some cases just creating for the first time, a regime that truly respects private property. And he wanted a strategy where it was subtle nullification, secession. You just ignore the edicts coming down from the federal government over time. And you try to avoid conflict as much as possible. And really describing in many ways what F.H. Buckley talks about in his book, American Secession, as well, and which Ron Paul has talked about in some cases. We're talking about de facto secession, but it doesn't require us installing a monarch. It doesn't require some sort of authoritarian regime. It's just recognizing that the voters in some places are going to be very different from the voters in other places. And those places where the voters take seriously the issue of freedom, those are places where you can start to really put together the beginnings of a state or a regime or a community or whatever you want to call it that could take private property seriously and maybe hopefully influence its neighbors.
Within that essay, he talks about the potential for a bottom-up revolution within kind of an American political context, where democracy can be used as a means of protecting property rights against aggressors rather than having it being used as kind of the soft variant of communism, as he discusses kind of democracy in theory. And so that's, I think that's why his work is so interesting, is that even as for all of his critiques, he recognizes that when we talk about bringing the world to a more classical liberal property rights grounded society, simply ignoring the parts that are not convenient and require working outside of kind of pure libertarian theory, simply ignoring them doesn't solve any problems. We need to reckon with the world as it exists today and try to figure out ways of changing the ideology of the masses towards that positive respect for property rights that is the grounding of civilization. Because otherwise, you're taking yourself out of the game entirely and at the will of, whatever the intellectual elites want society to go into. And that is not always a Hoppean monarch in practice. And so, again, there's Hoppe's work is far more nuanced in this in ways that I think have real value to the current political environment. Even a few years ago, he was talking about the changes that we've seen in the political society and addressing them full on. So again, it's very easy to simplify his critiques and his ideas, but reckoning with them thoroughly, I think, provides a lot more value.
Well, I think we're about out of time. Next time, I think we can expand a little bit on Rothbard's theory of populism and whether it works or not, because Rothbard certainly departs quite a bit from some of these more anti-democratic thinkers, and Rothbard tends to take the side of the Jacksonians or the Democrats and whoever it is that's doing this pro-democracy, expand the suffrage, fight the power centralized in Washington groups. And we asked that question this time, were they right? Does that actually work? But we didn't really answer the question. And so next time, I think we'll approach that maybe from a more empirical view. Can we come up with examples that show that maybe the populists were right? And is that a real strategy? So I hope you'll join us next time. And once again, thank you for joining us on Radio Rothbard. Have a great day.